Right, now we've officially begun. There's no going back. So this class we're discussing, right, the whole story of David and Avshalom, which is actually the longest single story in Sefer Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Beis. It begins in really Perek Yud Gimel, Perek Yud Dalet, and goes all the way until Perek Yud Tes. So we're dropping in this week in an interesting moment. We're beginning Perek Tes Zayin. So what happened in the previous week was Avshalom launched his rebellion, and we tried to show that David saw the rebellion come. It was quite obvious. Avshalom is a man of many talents, but subtlety is not one of them. So, for example, when Avshalom has a problem with Yoav, so he goes and gets his men to burn down Yoav's field. When he has a problem with his brother Amnon, he gets his men to go and murder Amnon. He's not somebody who goes with the quiet, subtle way. He is somebody who's very much a man of boldness and action and showy. And it seemed pretty obvious what Avshalom was up to. But David, who is still kind of mired in, you want to call it guilt and regret or tshuva, an almost paralysis, in reaction to his own sins with Uriah and Bathsheba, whatever exactly they were, we discussed that a while ago at some length, David kind of just feels paralyzed. You know, how can he take a stance as a moral paradigm when he knows what he's done wrong? So Avshalom launches his rebellion, and then all of a sudden David like shifted into action after all the time of not doing anything while Avshalom was moving more and more and more. David organizes his men. He has them flee from Yerushalayim. And then in the previous parak, while he's on his way out, so he bumps into three people. And if we can visualize Yerushalayim, so we know that you have Ir David, right? So you go to the Kotel and the southern wall excavations they have there. So you have Ir David, which is on the slope of Har Tzion. Then the mountain goes down to the valley, right, to Nahal Kidron, where they have the Chizkiyahu tunnels. And then you go up again to Har HaZeitim. And then once you cross over Har HaZeitim, now it, all of a sudden you hit the desert very, very quickly, and the elevation goes down very quickly until you get to the Jordan River and to the Yam HaMelech. It's been to Ma'al HaDumim. So you know, like you know, you're so close to Yerushalayim, but the climate is totally transformed. So David is on his way out, and he met three people as he was going out. So first he met his old friend Itai Hagiti, who's seems to be a convert from the land of the Plishtim, who is a very loyal ger, who is one of David's chief military lieutenants. He meets David as he's first leaving the city, going down the mountain towards the valley. There was like a Rus repeat moment that week, where at that moment, where David tells Itai, who's a ger, he says, "Don't come with me. There's no future for you. I'll consider it as if you did me a chesed." And Itai tells him, "Life or death doesn't matter. I'm sticking with you, David. I'm remaining loyal. I'm going to be there to help command your forces." You know, just like David's own ancestor, Rus, who was also a convert, did generations ago. They get to the bottom of the valley, and then David turns around. He sees coming behind him are the Kohanim, Eviasar and Tzadok, who are bringing the Aron. And then in a very, very important, really almost revolutionary religious moment, David tells them, bring the Aron back to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is now Ir HaKodesh, the place of the Aron. It doesn't belong with me. It belongs in Yerushalayim. And I do not need the physical presence of the Aron in order for Hashem to be with me. Hashem wants to be with me wherever I go. So I'm going to run away where I need to run away, and Hashem can help me from a distance. The physical box is not going to make such a difference. And we saw in Perek Gimel of Sefer Tehillim, which is Mizmor David Bivarchal Lifnei Avshalom Beno, the Mizmor that David wrote as he was running away from Avshalom, he refers to this as well. And Hashem is going to answer him, Mehar Kadsha. I'm going to be far away, but David always maintains Emunah in Hashem's ability to answer from afar. So, Ozzy, welcome aboard. And then the third person that David meets as he climbs up to Har HaZeitim, so he meets another friend, Hushai Ha'arki, who seems very smart, very wise, and he's one of David's oldest and wisest friends. David sends him to back to Yerushalayim undercover to serve as a spy, and that's going to be a pivotal moment this week. So load up the screen share. And the theme for this parak, now as Avshalom enters Yerushalayim, and it seems like Avshalom's victory is at its high point. He's coming proudly into the city. David is on the run. David only has a few hundred men with him. David is barefoot, poorly supplied, doesn't really seem to have much of a chance. It's a moment where the odds makers, you know, the Las Vegas odd makers, would be saying the game is really over. Avshalom has won and David has lost. And it's particularly in that moment, as we're going to see, that David consistently is going to display humility. And the theme on the other side, those who are opposed to David, is going to be arrogance and the dangers of it. Okay, so let's load up the screen share and we'll start learning through what's going to happen. So first the Nebi tells us that David, Avar ma'at meharosh. So it's as David begins to pass the top. Remember, he's now on the top of Har HaZeitim. So he is about to descend down that mountain to go all the way down towards Midbar Yehuda and then the Dead Sea. He's about to leave Yerushalayim behind. We need to appreciate this is an extremely emotional moment. You know, he is right now, he can still see Yerushalayim, but as he descends the mountain, so he will be cut off from view from Yerushalayim. As he looks, all he sees in front of him now is desert, the wilderness. When he was young and running away from Shaul, he thought that he was done with this. You know, we thought he was done with having to run away from the king who's trying to kill him. Now that's all coming back, and David has no idea what the future is going to hold. So it's at that moment of peak emotional vulnerability, as David is finally leaving Yerushalayim behind for the desert, the zone comes up, and it is Siva Na'ar Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, the son of Yonasan, who David did what the Navi called earlier, Chesed Elohim, this unbelievable kindness to, bringing Mephibosheth into Yerushalayim. Normally, the kings of old would just massacre the whole family of the king that they deposed. But far from that, David held to his covenant with Yehonasan. He brings Mephibosheth into Yerushalayim. He supports him. He gives him Shaul's entire royal estate. So he has Mephibosheth very rich. And he invites Mephibosheth to eat at his royal table every single day. So he's very, very close to Mephibosheth. He's done unbelievable chesed to him. Now, Tziva, who had basically embezzled Shaul's estate. He had been Shaul's like major domo. He had been his main servant. Once Shaul's family had been either wiped out or chased or ran away, Tziva kind of took advantage to take all the money for himself. David took him down several notches and said, you're now going to work for Mephibosheth. So Tziva is strongly, he sees an opportunity here, and we'll see the Malbim's analysis of his strategy, how Tziva is going to try to get David to give him everything he had given to Mephibosheth. You know, there are two groups of people in the world. When you see someone in pain, those who say, what can I do to help the person? And then there are those who say, never let an opportunity, a crisis go to waste. What can I, how can I maximize my own opportunity? You know, there's a war happening. There are some people who always get rich during a war. You know, some people find that as a chance to make lots of money doing profiteering. Well, Tziva is going to be very much in that latter category. And what he's going to do, you got to give him credit. You got to give him credit. The man may be evil, but the man's also brilliant. So what's he going to do? So the Navi says he brought some supplies. He brought some food for David. And David says to him, Ma'ilach, what is this? David begins with a kind of a cold response to Tziva. It's clear from the previous interaction that David and Tziva had, David does not like Tziva very much. He knows who Tziva is. Tziva had been the head servant in Shaul's house. David spent a lot of time in Shaul's house when he was younger. So David knows him. David doesn't like him. David says, what are you doing over here? And then Tziva says, here, this is the food and supplies for you. David asks, Aye ben Adonecha, where is the son of your master? It seems like he's referring to Mephibosheth, the grandson of Shaul. Tziva says, he remains in Yerushalayim. Why? Because Mephibosheth, the son of Yonasan, dreams that Bnei Yisrael are going to turn back and give him the throne. Very strange thing for Tziva to say. We'll see the Malbim's explanation of this. No one's making Shaul's house the king. Everyone is bringing in beautiful, charismatic, long-haired Avshalom to be the king. Why would they make a crippled Mephibosheth king? It seems like it comes out of nowhere. There is no reason for David to believe this. And yet David does. David says, okay, I'm giving you everything that I gave to Mephibosheth. So what exactly is going on? Why does David fall for it? What is so convincing about the story that Siva tells? So the Malbim makes two very important points over here for us to understand. The first is he says, hey, no one else came to help David. Right? Only Tziva. Tziva is the only one who comes to help David. And the Malbim explains that what Tziva did was brilliant because he set it up so that he couldn't lose. Either way, if David won, Tziva's going to win. And if Avshalom won, Tziva's going to win. How so? Let's look inside. Says the Malbim, Ha'eved hazeh malshin al Adonav, right? He is slandering his master Mephibosheth. Chashav la'pilas Adonav miman avshalom. Either way, he's going to destroy Mephibosheth and he'll come out on top. How so? Lifnei David, he did, he who hanosein kolzos. He tells David this whole story that Mephibosheth has gone to Avshalom's side, and I, Tziva, remain loyal to David. And so I am bringing you all of these supplies, hoping to get exactly what David tells him, to be awarded the estate. And then, says the Malbim, this is brilliant, Lifnei Avshalom, yecholomar. He could have told Avshalom, if Avshalom won, Adonav shalachu so. I was following orders. I'm just the Eved. Avshalom. I'm the biggest Avshalom fan. I desperately didn't want to go. My master forced me to bring supplies to David. My master is not on your side, Avshalom. He's on David's side. Right? And his master commanded him and sent to send the donkeys. And then what would have happened? Avshalom would have said, Mephibosheth, you're on David's side. That's it. Right? Get rid of Mephibosheth. Tziva, you, my loyal servant, can have Mephibosheth's estate. So either way, Tziva has set it up so that he can slander Mephibosheth simultaneously to both David and to Avshalom. Now, why on earth would Mephibosheth possibly become king? How could David believe that as a viable possibility? The Malbim explains this too, and it's also brilliant. What's happening right now? We have David who has done so much for Bnei Yisrael. Winning wars, saving their independence, setting up Yerushalayim, a viable economy, a viable nation, all the problems they've had for so many generations. And now if there's everything is so much better. But you get old, the next exciting thing comes around. Life is never perfect. Everyone has some complaints about the government. Now, nobody ever goes to vote on election day saying, I just am so ecstatic about everything perfect the government is doing. You know, life doesn't work that way. So along comes Avshalom, who's charismatic and energetic and convincing, and he's a man of the people. He's somebody who, on the one hand, presents himself as royalty, so everyone admires him, but Dafka, that royal prince, who's galloping around with 50 runners in a chariot, is also calling people over by name and making personal connections to them, which makes him more impressive. So in the moment, everyone loves Avshalom. He sweeps them away with his charisma. And they turn to Avshalom and turn away from David. But says the Malbim, what is going to happen long-term? Long-term, and we'll see in a few weeks that this is actually exactly what does happen. This does happen in a few weeks. Once the euphoria of revolt and revolution and beautiful, amazing Avshalom wears away. And at the end of the day, you know, Avshalom is the guy who's king when your garbage isn't being picked up on time and you're not getting the tax rates that you wanted and everything else that's annoying in life. People are going to reflect and they're going to say, who's our king? Who's our king now? We traded in David HaMelech, Mechaber Tehillim, for a son who's a Ben Soro Mora who rebelled against and murdered his own father. Long term, Avshalom's position is not going to be viable. But what are the people going to do if we play this out? Avshalom wins. David is gone. The people will then be disgusted by Avshalom. As after an Aveira, you know, the Yetzer Hara is always most irresistible before the Aveira. After it happens, you look back and you say, how could I have done this? they're still going to say, how can we have anointed and accepted Avshalom as our king? Well, then what's going to happen? No David, no Avshalom. We're going to want Avshalom. Let's go back to the previous royal house. Let's go back to Mephibosheth, the grandson of Avshalom. That is the political plan that Tziva sets up as being Mephibosheth's plot. You know, it's diabolical. So between his own presentation of Mephibosheth's plot, which, as we'll see, has roots in truth, not in terms of what Mephibosheth himself actually thinks, but in terms of the political reality of Bnei Yisrael, that's how it's going to play out. And any lie that is rooted in some truth, we know, is super powerful. It's the secret of the Meraglim next week, right? In Parashas Shelach. Between that and between how Tziva is advancing his own cause so that he can't lose, it's all around brilliant. That being said, David believing it is a major mistake, which ultimately Chazal are going to hold him more accountable for than anything else. Chazal are going to say that it's not Uriah or Bathsheba that causes David's kingdom to be split in two in the generation. It's going to be this mistake right here that he is going to believe Tziva and tear away the estate from Mephibosheth. Okay, so that happens here in the moment. We can understand where David is coming from, by the way. You know, Tziva, besides being brilliant in his plan, also catches David at his most vulnerable moment as he's leaving Yerushalayim. But you know, what happens, happens. And the Rambam also points out, it seems clear that there's a punishment for David, because the second after this interaction with Tziva, where David wrongly takes away the estate of Mephibosheth, so now he seems to immediately get punished, because he's on his way. He's leaving Yerushalayim, so he's on his way east, and he passes Bahurim, which is a city from Shevet Binyamin. It came up in the Sefer earlier. A man comes out. He's clearly an important man from the house of Shaul, named Shimi ben Gera. And what is Shimi ben Gera doing? He's cursing David and throwing rocks. What does he say? He says, "Tzei tzei ish adamim v'ish havliyah." Right? Go out, man of blood, you base fellow. Heshiv alech Hashem kol dmei beis Shaul. Hashem is paying you back for having destroyed the house of Shaul. Asher malach tatzav, yitain Hashem es hamulucha biyad Avshalom banecha. Hashem has given the throne to your son Avshalom. Binei berasecha ki ish damim ata. It's an exceptionally harsh line from Shimon. What's very important about this, though, is understanding where Shimi is coming from. Now, we've grown up, since we were little, we were told about David HaMelech. So we know David HaMelech is the good guy. The Navi has taken great pains to demonstrate that at no point did David ever try to undermine the family of Shaul. We have here the first example, and this is going to be a theme in the parak, of the danger of arrogance. And the arrogance of Shimi ben Gera is that he feels confident enough to read the mind of Ribono Shel Olam. He thinks he can explain why Hashem is doing what he's doing. And he is wrong. Now, one level, he's correct. There's one line here which is correct, which is, Yitain Hashem es hamulucha biyad Avshalom benach. Shimi sees what's happening. He says, this is not natural. It cannot be that through any natural, normal political course of events, a king as successful and beloved as David would be so dramatically turned against by his own people supporting his own son. There has to be the hand of God in this. And in that regard, he is absolutely correct. David is being punished for the sin of Uriah and Bathsheba. The Navi Nathan had told David, this is going to happen. The evil is going to come out of your own house. That's happening. David knows he's being punished. However, what Shimi is totally incorrect about is why Hashem is punishing David. Shimi, from the house of Shaul, looks at the events, and from his perspective, what does he see? He sees a David who, when he ran away from Shaul, ended up fighting together with the Plishtim. He then saw a David who was engaged in a civil war against Ish-bosheth, Shaul's son. He saw David's general Yoav assassinate Avner, the general of Shaul. He saw David never do anything to Yoav. He saw other men assassinate Ishbosheth. He looks and he sees them from his perspective. David has been destroying the house of Shaul at every turn. There's one other piece, which has not yet come up in the Navi. The end of Sefer Shmuel is written a little bit out of order. And there's a very difficult, really bizarre, and really challenging story in Shmuel Beis Perek Chaf Aleph. After the story of David and Bathsheba, of David and Avshalom, the Navi goes back in time and tells a story about when the Hashem sends a drought for 3 years against Bnei Yisrael. Long story short, it happens because of Hashem is punishing Bnei Yisrael for what happened to the Givonim, you know, the group of Canaanim who had convinced Yeshua to give them a treaty under false pretenses. Shaul had killed a bunch of the Givonim. Not for now to speculate as to why exactly that happened. The Givonim, who are very cruel, say we want revenge. They demand the death of 7 members of Shaul's household. David is able to save Mephibosheth, but he hands over 7 other men of Shaul's family, of Shaul's grandchildren, to be murdered by Givon. So Shimi, who has seen this, thinks that David is just in league. David is using this. So he's assassinated Avner, allegedly. He betrayed Shaul, allegedly. He killed 7 of Shaul's grandsons, allegedly. He's wrong at every single stage. The failure to be Dan Lakaf Sefus, right? The thinking from his own perspective, Shimi had it better when Shaul was in charge. But Shimi wants to read things as, David is being punished because of what I think he did to my family, right? And it's a consistent problem in Sefer Shmuel, which is people who interpret the will of God conveniently. Conveniently, Hashem wants what I want. Conveniently, Hashem is doing what I want him to do. The best example of this in the Sefer was actually Shaul HaMelech himself, Shimi's relative. When some members of Yehuda come to Shaul when David is on the run, and they tell Shaul, here are the coordinates, here's exactly where David is hiding. And Shaul tells them, Bruchim Atem Lashem, you get a bracha, Hashem is so happy and proud of you that you have told me where David is. Because the Rebbe Shaul wants me to be king and to get rid of David. It is constantly the Achilles heel of Shaul. Shaul's very firm. Problem is, he thinks that Hashem wants what he wants. And we have the same thing with Shimi over here. He misinterprets and imagines that what he wants, which is the defeat of David, and he wants David to get comeuppance for the imagined murder of Shaul's family. He thinks that's what's happening over here with the rebellion of Avshalom. Okay, now in stark contrast to the behavior of Shimi, we have the unbelievable humility of David. David does not do very well in the Mephibosheth and Siva moment, but here is one of David's shining moments. So Abishai ben Tsruya, David's nephew, one of his head generals, so he says, "Lami yakalil hakelef hamesazes adni amelach. How dare this dead dog curse the king? Now let me go over there. The Asir Es Roshel. Let me behead him." Okay. Abishai does not mess around. David says no, but it's fascinating why he says no. He doesn't just say leave him alone. He says, "Ki Hashem amar lo kalel asavit." It's possible that Hashem is the one doing this. Now wait a second. How can David ascribe things to God? There's no Navi that told David this is happening. The key difference, though, is that do we ascribe things to Hashem that are for our benefit or that are for our growth? And Shimi is saying, I always wanted David punished, and now I see David being, Hashem is doing what I want. David is telling Abishai, Hashem is bringing punishment upon me. And he says, look, let him curse. And ulai yireh Hashem be'ini v'yishiv Hashem li tova tachas kol hayom hazeh. Maybe Hashem will bring me back. No guarantees, no predictions, but David says, I'm going to respond to this as a message and punishment from Hashem, and I will react accordingly. Rav Soloveitchik would always talk about the way we react to God is not by asking why, but by asking what. What am I supposed to do in response to this? I see a message. What is the appropriate religious response? And David's response to the cursing is, I interpret this as punishment. It is something for me to endure, me to suffer from, and me to grow from. Is that going to guarantee, oh, I just needed to put in the, you know, kapara points, and then Hashem will bring me back to Yerushalayim? No guarantees. He's not in this for the, he's not doing this so that Hashem will bring me back. He knows it's only ulai yireh Hashem. On the one hand, he maintains hope, maintains faith. Other people may think it's a lost cause, because David has like five men and a trail of dust against all of Israel. So David has hope. He knows that Hashem can always bring him back if he wants to. But he humbly accepts the punishment. He tells Avishai, do not touch that man, right? And who knows what will happen, will happen. Okay, so now David goes on his way. That's it, right? David is now descended. He's on his way down out into the wilderness. David is in the low of lows. So now we shift back, and the rest of the parak is going to talk about what's going to happen with Avshalom. But the Navi, many times, the Navi very subtly gets like a little dig in that Avshalom. So a very important example of this is that the Navi never calls Avshalom a king. David will call Avshalom king. Some people will call Avshalom a king. The Navi never calls Avshalom king. And look carefully what the Navi does in Pasuk Yudal, Pasuk Tesvav. It's kind of funny. So the Navi says, "Vayavo hamelech v'chol ha'am asher ito ayifin." Right? The king and all the people with him arrived tired, ve'nafesh sham, and he refreshed himself when they broke camp, when they made camp. The Avshalom v'chol ha'am ish Yisrael bo Yerushalayim v'achito fel ito, and Avshalom, everyone with him, came to Yerushalayim. So we have two groups, right? Two psukim. We have two leaders with two groups of people with them. On one level, it seems like Avshalom is on the ups and David is on the downs. David is somewhere in the desert, exhausted and abandoned, ayifin, while Avshalom is coming and he is with Ish Yisrael, all the impressive men of Israel, and they are not somewhere in the desert. There is a triumphant procession into Yerushalayim. But how does the Navi undermine it? With one word. One word punctures this vision of David having collapsed and of Shalom being the one riding high. See, the Navi very deliberately doesn't say, "Vayavo David, the Cholam Asherita." Navi could have easily said that. Navi says, "Vayavo Hamelech." The king. Who's the king? Not of Shalom. The man with the crown and the chariots and the procession and the palace and the capital city and all the excitement and fanfare and music and everything. He's not the king. The king is David. So the Navi very subtly, but very specifically, sticks that message in. To the naked eye, Avshalom is the one who's victorious, but, Hashem does not look at the world through the same lenses that a regular person would. So now Avshalom is in the city, and along comes Hushai Ha'arki. David's old friend, right, who David met on the top of Parzesim and said, go back to Yerushalayim. So you got to give Avshalom credit for chutzpah over here. Avshalom is going to say maybe the most chutzpahdik sentence in all of Shmuel, all of Tanakh, all of history. This is a pretty jaw-dropping chutzpahdik thing for Avshalom to say. Let's see. Hushai runs up to Avshalom and he says, Yechi Hamelach, Yechi Hamelach. Okay. Long live the king, long live the king. Mefarshim point out, he's not technically lying, because how does Avshalom know which king we're talking about? And specifically, given the point we made earlier, Hushai can be saying Yechi HaMelech, and Avshalom thinks he's referring to himself, but deep down, Hushai is kind of laughing on the inside, because he's really thinking about it. But look what Avshalom says. Zechas techas reyacha. Avshalom says to Hushai, that is your friend. Here's your chesed. Here's your loyalty to your friend. Where's the loyalty, Hushai? Your best friend, David. You abandoned, you betrayed your best friend to come for me? This coming from the son who has betrayed and is trying to murder his father. This is like the kettle calling, the pot calling the kettle black, except far worse. But what better example do we have of Avshalom's narcissism? total narcissism every step of the way with Avshalom. He does not see any flaws in himself. And physically, he doesn't have any flaws. The Navi literally said he is physically perfect. He doesn't have a single physical defect. But he doesn't see any spiritual defects in himself. Ad kedei kach, that in his moment of rebelling against his father, having betrayed his own father, could turn to somebody and say, where's your loyalty? Unbelievable. Where's your loyalty coming from Avshalom? So Hushai responds, and Hushai says, no, I wasn't loyal to your father per se. I was loyal to the office. You know, you say, not the Gavra, the Chavtza. I was loyal to the king. And clearly, Hashem has chosen you. Whoever Hashem has chosen, shouldn't I be with him? Okay, now what a way to play up to Avshalom's vanity. One of the things we've seen is that Avshalom desperately wants legitimacy. He tried very, 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 very hard to be, before the rebellion, to be established as the recognized crown prince of David. Because it's not just that Avshalom wants the power of being king. He wants that. He wants legitimacy. He wants it all. He wants the respect. He wants the kabbalah. That's the one thing that Avshalom is about. Hushai is going to read him like a T. We're going to see that a little bit in these couple of psukim, and then we're really going to see that next week. That Hushai sees that Avshalom's exclusive driving force is his ego, his vanity, his desire for kavod, and Hushai is going to use that to completely manipulate it, which is really fantastic, because Avshalom until this point has been manipulating everybody he comes in contact with. Now he is going to get manipulated by the manipulator. So Hushai begins right away by just playing to Avshalom's vanity. Everyone's the Am has chosen you, right? The people, the leaders, the Ish Yisrael, Hashem has chosen you. Everyone's chosen you, Avshalom. I can get the message. Clearly, I should get on board. So he's telling Avshalom, you're so wonderful. You're so popular. The Amcha loves you. The aristocrats love you. The Ribono Shalom loves you. I have no choice. I need to set aside whatever personal preferences I have, and I'm going to fall in line with the will of the people. And then he says to Avshalom, second of all, who am I serving? I'm serving Lifnei Beno, I'm serving the son of David. So in a sense, I am being loyal to David, because Avshalom, you are David's son, so me being loyal to you is an extension of being loyal to your father. Avshalom, who desperately wants the legitimacy and recognition as the son of David, Avshalom wants to have his cake and eat it too. Right? He wants to rebel against his father to take his crown, but he also wants the legitimacy from his father to be Avshalom ben David, the king of the Davidic line. Again, a chutzpah from Avshalom, but again, it's always the narcissistic person who's able to have no problem in a situation of total self-hypocrisy. That's where Avshalom is holding, and that is where Hushai is completely feeding into it. And it works. It works. He gets on board. He's added to the staff. Right. So you see, we've seen the arrogance of Shimi in terms of his personal extrapolation of what Hashem wants. We've seen the humility of David, his accepting the Ratzon Hashem and being open to not knowing what it is for sure, interpreting things in a way where he should accept whatever is coming to him. He accepts punishment. He's going to get cursed out like a dog, as Avishai said, and having rocks thrown at him. He's not going to react. Stay humble and keep going. And then we have the arrogance of Avshalom in his moment of pride, right? Who through that is being manipulated into Hushai, who's going to use this to his advantage next week to really destroy Avshalom. Now, the last point in the parak, right, we bring in Achitofel. Achitofel, the advisor of Avshalom, who the Navi told us earlier was so smart that when he gives advice, it was the equivalent of advice being given by a Navi. Well, so we'll see. We got to wonder. We'll see more about this maybe in a week or two, if the advice that Achitofel here gives is actually effective. It's definitely going to be effective in the short tactical sense. The question is, did it actually work? So Avshalom says to Achitofel, what should we do? So Achitofel immediately says something shocking to Avshalom. He says, David has left 10 Pilag Shim in the palace, and you should go and have relations with those 10 Pilag Shim. Why? He says, Vishama kol Yisrael ki nivashta es avicha. This is going to burn the bridges with your father. You've abhorred your father. V'chazku yidei kol asher itach. They'll strengthen those who are with you. Now, how is that going to work? So Rashi explains. you have people here who are on the fence. They like Avshalom, but Avshalom is young, he's new, he's rebelling against his father. How are they supposed to be convinced that Avshalom means business? What could happen tomorrow? Avshalom can wake up and regret what he's done, make amends with his father. The father will forgive the son. They know the father is not going to forgive all the people who supported Avshalom. So they're all kind of holding back. So Achitofel advises, what you need to do is burn the bridges with David. Assault your father's Pilag Shin. Now there will be no going back, and that's going to convince the people to be on your side. That is the advice of Achitofel. It's brilliant tactically. You know, as a piece of political advice, it's excellent. It is unclear, very unclear, though, how effective it actually is. Some of the modern Mefarshim points out that where we are right now, David has like nobody in his army. You know, he has a few stragglers who came with him from Yerushalayim. In a couple of weeks, he's all of a sudden going to have a much larger force. One reason for that will be he's going to get the other side of the Jordan River, where the people like David. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that in 2 weeks. One possibility also is that Avshalom may have alienated more people than he actually acquired by doing this. We've seen earlier that rape in particular was almost uniquely abhorred by Bnei Yisrael, going all the way back to the time of Dina and Shimon and Levi, continuing with Amnon and Tamar. Not only that, but Avshalom demonstrates his own hypocrisy with what happens over here. Okay, we should just understand, based on the source sheet, we should realize that David is clearly being punished. You know, the punishment warning that Nathan had given to David, that someone is going to sleep with your wives out in the open. So that happens here literally. Okay, we should just note that. But let's talk about Avshalom for a second, Avshalom's hypocrisy. The whole Avshalom story got started when Avshalom's half-sister Tamar was brutally raped and assaulted by Amnon, Avshalom's half-brother. At the time, right, Avshalom wrapped himself up in moral virtue and moral righteousness and rage and anger. He waited 2 years and he killed Amnon. Now, he argued at the time that what was really motivating Avshalom was seeing this as an opportunity to get rid of Amnon, who was the crown prince. We saw the very strong parallels that the Navi drew between the whole story of Amnon's rape of Tamar and the story of Dina and Shechem. And we talked about the explanation that my Rabbi Rosenzweig gives for the whole episode of Shimon and Levi. What's the massive mystery there? At the end of the story in Vayishlach, so Yaakov yells at Shimon and Levi, and they yell back, and they say, "Hachazona yasas achoseinu," and Yaakov has no response. It's quiet. Then all of a sudden, Vayachi, what happened? In Vayachi, along comes Yaakov Avinu, and he says, "Arur apamki az." You're like, wait a second, Yaakov, you're cursing Shimon and Levi's anger now, years and years later in Vayachi. Why didn't you respond in Vayishlach? So Rosenzweig explains that it was too early to tell. There is a consistent, very, very moralistic language that we see in the story of Shimon and Levi with Shechem. Hakazoni yasas achoseinu nevala asher lo yasakim b'Yisrael. There are many lines where Shimon and Levi say we're taking a principled moral stand. This cannot be abided. And Yaakov, you're going to come with us with your national security evaluations, and we need to figure out how can we respond? Will the response be proportionate? We need to live in the land with these people. And Shimon Levi say, no, our sister was attacked and we need to respond. We're hyper loyal to our sister. Well, what is Yaakov, if that indeed was the case, if they really were motivated by moral fervor in defense of their sister, that'll be one thing. If they're being motivated by more base emotions of rage and anger, that's a different conversation entirely. And what happens between Vayishlach and Vayachi to demonstrate that Shimon and Levi's motivations were not the lofty, that their number one value in life is sibling loyalty? was the fact that they sell Yosef into slavery. So in Vayechi, along comes Yaakov Avinu, and he says, I see now that what you were doing in Vayishlach was not being done by loyalty to a sibling. It was done from anger, and now we can say Arur Apam Ki'as. Well, now we have the same exact thing happening in Sefer Shmuel Beis. Avshalom wrapped himself up, right, in moral fervor, the rage, the righteous rage against Amnon. How could Amnon pop raping Tamar? Unbelievably evil. Again, all B'nai Yisrael agree. But what does Avshalom do? What does Avshalom do three prakim later? The exact same thing. And not once, but 10 times. And not in private, but in public. Why? Because it's going to benefit him politically. So Avshalom once again exposes the total hypocrisy that's at his core. Right? Now, even hypocrites will tell themselves they're doing things for the right reasons. But we take a step back and we look at Avshalom and we see he is completely motivated by a desire for power. And the image we're trying to build up of Avshalom is essentially somebody with absolutely no redeeming features. It's the reason why Chazal present him as the paradigmatic Ben Sorer Umor. There's absolutely nothing good in Avshalom. That is going to make David's reaction at the end particularly challenging and particularly powerful. But we look at his behavior in Perek Gimel when he was with Amnon. Lo diber Avshalom im Amnon mirab yato. Kisanei Avshalom es Tamnon al davar asher ina es Tamar chasel. He was so furious he couldn't talk to him. Three prakim later, man does the same thing and does even worse. Right. At the end of the day, it's the arrogance that allows Avshalom to behave this way. It's the arrogance that has Achitophel giving this advice. Achitophel, who thinks he's the smartest man in all of Israel. I'm going to see Achitophel's advice next week. Right? The Dan Mikra. Yeah, the Dan Mikra commentary points out over here. Maybe he was tactically successful in the moment. But, you know, when you throw all values out and you're all about realpolitik, that's not going to work out for you either. And I think the best way to end is with the Pesukim and Mishlei over here. Kano Chachma, right? The best thing is to have wisdom. Mesilas yisharim sur mira. And if you want to be right, so don't ask yourself the clever strategies and stratagems and ideas, asking the tzivas about their plots and asking the achitofels about their ideas. They may all be very, very smart and intelligent, the tzivas and achitofels of the world. But mesilas yisharim sur mira. If you want to be a chacham, you want to be with the yisharim, the guideline is what's right and what's wrong. And right connected with that, Lifnei Sheber Gaon, the famous line that pride comes before the destruction. And that's what we have with Avshalom and with Achitophel on one hand, and with David on the other. Okay, so with that, we'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, let's talk. Otherwise, we'll break and we'll come back with Perek Yud Zayin next week.
Thank you very much.
All right, have a good night, everybody.
Appreciate it. Good night.